Converting from gas-powered cars to electric is a key component to fighting climate change. But for many drivers, the lack of charging infrastructure is a major barrier to entry. But that's starting to change. As of May 2023, the U.S. had installed just shy of 140,000 charging stations, many of which are in urban centers. So how does a company tackle creating an infrastructure for people everywhere to charge up their EVs?
You're listening to Found, TechCrunch's podcast that brings you the stories behind the startups from the folks that are building them. Today, we're talking with Louis Tremblay, the CEO and founder of Flow, which is a company that manufactures EV charging stations for public charging spots and to be installed in homes. I'm Becca Skutak, and here with me is my electrifying co-host,
Dominic Midori Davis. And of course, before we get into our conversation, we have our two truths and a lie. So listen carefully to see which one of these statements is not true. Is it that working with both the US and Canadian governments was easier than expected? That Louis knew he was going to be a founder by the time he was 8? Or that Flow launched an at-home supercharger that can give cars 80% of battery power in 15 minutes?
And before we dive fully into the conversation, if you wouldn't mind taking a second to just rate and review the show on whatever platform you are already listening to this episode on, we would greatly appreciate it. We won't delay any further, but here is our conversation with Louis. Hey, Louis, how's it going?
Pretty good, Becca. Pleased to meet you. Pleased to meet you, Dominic, as well.
Pleased to meet you. And I will say, are you based in Quebec?
I'm based in Quebec City, yeah.
So I am unfortunately legally obligated to ask you that. Not really anyone who actually knows anything about legal contracts, but are you a Canadiens fan?
I'm a Canadiens fan, but I have to say I used to be a Nordic fan.
Oh, yes.
Back in the days. So I'm not as passionate about hockey as I was.
No, I'm a Bruins fan, so we probably shouldn't talk about hockey too much anyway.
Yeah, it's not a good subject for us.
So why don't we dive into what we are here to talk about? Why don't you tell us a little bit about Flow?
Sure. Flow was born in 2009. As an entrepreneur, I'm in the EV since 2004. And the mission of Flow is really to accelerate the EV adoption, providing the best charging experience, whether it's at home, at work, on the go. So we provide 100% of the need of an EV drivers, and we want to bring a comprehensive experience. So whether it's great product, great interface, the mobile app, the integration with OEM, with utilities. So the goal is really to provide an easy access to charging for, you know, EV drivers to enjoy their EV car. And I'll give you a little bit of numbers. We have more than 100,000 chargers deployed in North America. We are the dominant player in Canada, but definitely growing into the States. This is where we're expecting to grow the more in the next coming years. We are excited because today we're launching our new X-Series home products. So it's three products providing the needs of 100% of consumer. We've launched over the last year, but we're started to produce. Today, we had the first unit produced in Michigan of our Ultra Charger. So something that can charge 80% of your battery pack in 15 minutes. So really excited about that product that was 3 years in the making. But yes, it's where Flow is right now.
And I'm so interested about this company because we talk about EVs now all the time and more people are buying them. And the infrastructure, especially around chargers, have become such a bigger part of like general infrastructure conversations. I know we're talking about it a lot here in New York City, like having the city install chargers that anyone can use, et cetera. But you guys started this company back in 2009 when EVs were not as big of a part of the conversation. And I'm curious, how did you get interested in this space to begin with?
Yeah, that's a long story, but I just want to use you. You've talked about New York. It was one of our first customer in the US, and we're really proud because when I was talking about experience, one thing we've been doing, as you mentioned, for a long time, 15 years, is that a great charging experience starts with a reliable charging experience. And in New York, with the curbside charger we've deployed in every of the 5 boroughs, last year, they made a study, you know, they get their own data. You know, usually we have our own data, but 99% of the station were working all the time. What I mean by that, in our industry, we monitor reliability with uptime. So 99% uptime. And why I'm talking to you about this is it really demonstrates who Flow is. For the last 15 years, we've not installed dots on the map as many have. But we have deployed a reliable network, a network that you can always depend on. And that's what I'm the most proud of. So back to your questions, I fell in love in 1997 on climate change. I wanted to turn that into a business. I always have been an entrepreneur. In 2003, when I started my undergrad, I really didn't like it. Was electrical engineering, too techy, not enough practice. So I decided to fund a project in 2004, 20 years ago, to build an electric car. I fell in love with EVs. I started to see how can I bring more EVs on the road. People were talking about the range, comparing EVs at golf cart, and there were not that many EVs around the road at that time. And I strongly believe that EVs would disrupt the internal combustion engine cars because of lithium-ion battery. It was easy to calculate the potential autonomy, the potential efficiency there. So I decided to be the answer of that question, where people's going to charge, and bring charging in a simple, fluid way, in a flow way, at home, at work, and on the go. And it really snowballed when we started officially the company in 2009 and started to really deliver on our promise to bring reliable chargers to any new EV comers. There were not that many at the time, but definitely it has snowballed in the last 15 years.
That's so interesting because we so often talk to not even just founders, but you see it in government policy. You see it in a lot of areas where it's like, okay, everyone's doing this thing now. And like, oh, whoops, we never built the infrastructure for it, which is exactly why New York is now like, oh, crap, people are buying EVs. And like, we should have thought about this 5 years ago. So it's really interesting to hear that you guys kind of like entered the space early, knowing that if and when EVs got adoption, they were obviously going to need a way to charge.
Yeah, totally, Becca. And one thing that I want to stress is we've deployed hundreds, if not billions of dollars since 15 years. The problem with a lot of infrastructure that have been deployed is they don't last, they don't work. So this is why flow is so different. Like, we have product that have been installed for 15 years, still working, still being updated with software, and still meeting our 98% promise of uptime. My point is, it's not only about how we're going to pour public and private money to build infrastructure, but making sure we have standards like the federal standard for the Navy deployment program in the States. It's required 97% uptime. We didn't have that performance standard before. It's something we push a lot in the industry because the worst thing we have to fulfill our mission is that people embark into the EV journey, and the first trip they make, when they get in front of a charger, it doesn't work for any reasons. And that's the promise we've been fulfilling for the last 15 years.
And speaking of the chargers, since you got into this like a long time ago, how has the process of sourcing a lot of the hardware to create these charging stations evolved as I assume the industry has progressed these past decades?
I'll start by saying to really understand who Flow is we're a charging network operator. This means that we need a charger, right? So we have developed, back to your question, we have developed a manufacturing part. So we develop our own product, the new Ohm series we're bringing to market, the three product, the Ultra chargers. But we've been developing standard charging that charge you overnight or ultra fast charging. The point, we've have that manufacturing hardware division or role we're playing. We have software where people don't understand how much software is, but we're around 600 employees at Flow. We have 150 in the product, the development only, not manufacturing, only the product, and 75% is software. And all the software is the connection with the vehicle, the mobile app, managing the members, managing the energy is really important if you want to bring a great experience. So hardware is important because it's the infrastructure that lasts. Software is to make a great experience. And on the other side, you use the hardware and software to operate a great network, to answer phone, to look at your alarming system that tell you, oh, this station needs maintenance. If not, it's going to be a uptime killer. So we have all those vertical. But back to your question about sourcing, we have manufacturing plants in Canada. We have one in Auburn Hills, Michigan. And we have a great source of partners to be able to deliver tens of thousands of chargers every year. I would say we're shipping right now around 5,000 to 8,000 charger every month. So you have to make sure you can source the component. Obviously, through COVID, through the supply chain, it's been a challenge. But with our new generation coming with the latest and greatest, we have secure our supply chain. We have all the new microprocessor that are leading edge, that are growing in the foundries and everything. But it's been a challenge. But it's really important to understand who's Flow. We're not only a software company. We're not only a network. We're doing those three sports, which is, you know, manufacturing, developing software, and operating a network, call it service, a network.
With a similar vein, with the company starting before a lot of people were interested in the space the same way they are now, what has it been like fundraising? Because I know you guys have raised a substantial amount of venture funding, but I'm sure it wasn't as easy of a sell back when people weren't as interested in this space. So what has it been like fundraising for Flow, and how has it changed in the different rounds you guys have done?
That's a great question, because when you start a business, you know you're going to have to fundraise, but you don't know how much you're going to need to fundraise. It's a up and down. I would say there's years that it's easier for sure, like 2 years ago, 2 years and a half, the returning of COVID was easier. It's harder right now, but we're fortunate. We're backed by a great investor that support our mission and believe in what we've accomplished for the last 15 years. But definitely, when we started, it's a challenge, because what's your market, Louis? There were no market back in 2009. So it's being created. So you make your way in with some love money, your own money, some government grants for R&D, for instance, or DOE grants that, you know, you can use to do some prototyping or some commercialization help. So it was really a tough journey until, I would say, where we really started to raise equity money with our first big Series A in 2016. Mm. So 7 years after our foundations, which is pretty big. And now we're raising our Series E right now. So it's been a great journey. And I would say one thing that I learned comparing myself to other players is we're really cash efficient as a French Canadian. Big proud there. We do more with less.
And I also wanted to ask about the concept here, because EV is one of those interesting industries where some people get tax credits for owning an EV, or there are different regulations around cars, but as well as, I'm assuming, around charging as well. And knowing that you guys manufacture and operate in both the US and Canada, we just recently had a company on that tried to bring logs over the Canadian border and they got stopped. And it was this whole ordeal because of the different border laws and agriculture and stuff, which obviously this is very different. But I am curious, because you do operate sort of on both sides of the border in manufacturing and on the actual customer facing side. Is there anything there that's like you guys have to keep your eye on, or like, oh, when we do this in Canada, we have to do it this way. We do it in the US, we have to do it this way. Like, how is it managing that kind of stuff?
Oh my God. This is a big thing. When you start a business, I'm telling you, I didn't know how much regulation, public affair we needed to do, but it's key. You believe it's key. Like, our industry won't happen overnight. It's been 15 years and it will be another 15, if not 30 years. The point is, we are fighting climate change. We are transitioning the way we power our transports. We're doing the energy transition. So it's a big revolution. And you know, there's a pain, right? The climate change, the GHG, there's a pain, but we have to make sure that every stakeholder, private, the governments, utilities, OEM, we're making that transition. And there's business, there's jobs during that transition. So it's something that I learned, and it's really important for our business, is really to work with everyone, to be really collaborative, because at some point we need a price for the carbon. At some point, if the car are too expensive, they will be cheaper. Like the bill of material, if you look at a car, a toy you had when you were young, it's really easy to manufacture compared to internal combustion engine car. Mm-hmm. But you have to have a certain volume to amortize as an investment. So this is why our industry need to support the government that have GHG target, that I have longer mission-driven target to help the world to succeed. So this is why we need to monitor, work in collaboration, but every state's, even though you have some federal requirement, every state has different, like California is so different than others. You want to make sure you're in California. You want to make sure you understand, influence the rules, because it's going to pour in every state after. It's going to pour at the federal level. So yes, it's definitely something that I learned, and something that, you know, governments have been great partners, and OEMs and the utilities. We all have a different agenda. On our side, we live and die with EVs. So if we're not able to deploy infrastructure that are being used, we're dead, right? Others has more implication, and depending of which candidate, and we won't make policy here today, but which candidate in Canada, in states, and at the federal level, you know, it really evolved. But at the end of the day, we need to make that transition over 30 years. So definitely a big hot topic, But I cannot hammer that more and more. I need to work with all those stakeholders, with our competitors, to make that transition happening over time.
And the idea of regulation made me think about the EU forcing Apple to make one charger for all of their devices. And so I started thinking, when you're creating, or when you have like an EV charger, how does that work when, I guess, not all EV charging ports are the same? Like, I'm assuming different cars have different EV chargers. And so how do you kind of create one charger that works for all these different cars?
Back in the days, we decided what was the standard in 2007. But since then, there were two main chargers. There were the, what I call the Apple charger, the Tesla charger connector. It's just the connector. And I would say the industry standard. What we've seen in last year, and I'm glad that it happened after all, is most OEM, most large and small OEM have decided to move, car manufacturer have decided to move to the Tesla standards. So the G3400 standard. So now we're seeing that the two standards that used to coexist, but only Tesla for Tesla charger and our universal charger used to charge Tesla and every car in the market. Now with our product, the product we're launching today, our own product, we have the Tesla charger, our the G1772, which used to be the standards, but I'm expecting in the next 3 years it will merge. We will convert many chargers, and at the end we'll have only one port. But everything in behind, mostly everything behind, is compatible with every car.
Are the two chargers, is that something like the industry just agreed on, or did the government swoop in and say, no, you guys need to do a standard charger?
On that side, regulators, standard body have decided on universal, and for years it was both, but the industry decided last year, the OEM decided to embrace the Tesla connector, which now will be only, hopefully in 3 years, only one cord, but to any chargers you'll be able to access in the coming 3 years. For instance, you'll have an adapter. I have a Tesla and I have a pickup for Lightning. So when I plug into my own flow network, I don't use an adapter. When I plug into a Tesla, I use an adapter. When I'm driving my Tesla and I use the flow, I have an adapter. But when I plug to Tesla, I don't have an adapter. And this will merge as the industry is converging in the next 3 years, which is a great news for everyone, because any charger in the market will be a charger when everyone can charge.
And what is it like for you guys if you do have to kind of make the changes or make the adaptations to the existing charging stations as you have? As a company, is that like a really big undertaking, or is it not as daunting as I'm making it up to be in my mind?
It's not a big deal for us. I cannot speak for others because we're vertically integrated. So we control our own hardware, our own software. We have a services team and we have service partner for, you know, all the states, all the provinces of Canada. So we're able to make that transition. There's a couple of hoops. You need the standard, the connector to be standardized so you can use it. But beside that, it's pretty simple for the player we are, because we control every aspect of our network.
And that's interesting you brought up having the Tesla and the Ford Lightning, because I was definitely going to ask you about what kind of EV you drove, because I assumed you did drive one. So it is fun to hear that you do drive a Tesla and a Ford Lightning, because I know here in the US, at least, the Ford Lightning was like the big launch in EV land. Like, I feel like people who weren't interested in the space like got interested because of the Ford Lightning. So it is interesting to hear that you do drive both, because they're both very, I mean, they're approaching the market very differently.
Yeah, I'm kind of a tech guy, I would say. So I love to test the product for sure. And I like to compare the Tesla one, you know, compared to, I would say, the big tree like Ford. I love my pickup. I'm a hunter, I'm a fisher, I have three kids. It's awesome. You go everywhere. It's really robust. It's reliable as the flow network. So it's perfect. And I know like the Silverado just came out, bigger batteries. And there's so many products that are happening for now, back to 2009, where there were no car. So what's interesting these days is EVs grow 50% year over year. You know, there's a big bad publicity right now because it's not as big of a thing than when we returned from COVID, but it's still growing massively. For us, it's really hard to sustain kind of the, I would say, 60 to 70% growth year over year. But the point is, for once, the consumer is in the driver's seats, because now there is enough supply, there is enough product for the hunter that I am, or, you know, the urban people to have an EV that suits their needs. And now dealership needs to be able to sell those products. Before, it used to be, oh, take this one full price and maybe you'll have it in 2 years. now is that they have inventory. So they need to be as creative as they were with internal combustion engines. So we see the market evolving where consumer will have more power. And we've seen the price of the car, the lithium, the battery packs diminishing. So it's getting more and more accessible. And that's what we want. We want everybody to be able to access a charger for sure, but everybody to be able to access an EVs. So the price parity is coming faster than what we were expecting.
More from this conversation right after a quick break.
And before we start diving deeper, I guess, into you, I wanted to ask about the logistics of setting up charging stations in cities like New York, because I imagine you have to go through a lot of the government bureaucracy. Like, how easy is that? And where do you decide to put a charger? Like, how does that work?
It's really easy, Dominic. It's challenging. It's really challenging. And we've done one thing, one segment that is niche for us. And we've been very successful in Montreal, Toronto, Vancouver, and then New York, and then LA. It's curbside charger. And they are the most used chargers. Why? Because people use them overnight because they live close to the street. People work in the city and they will use. Someone that is driving from Philadelphia to New York will use it over the day to have some meeting. So the point is they are so much used. It's so critical because there's many garage orphans. There's not enough places to charge. So it's really challenging, though. You can imagine all the regulation rules from the parking, from the mayor, from the aesthetic, from the other product, the energy provider, Con Edison for New York, for instance. So there's many people. So big meeting. But when you start to work with the same objective, which is electrifying the curbside, it's something that starts slower. But when it started, accelerate. And that's what I'm expecting. From New York, from LA, from Montreal, like it's thousands of stations we've been deployed in the city, and it's really driving the EV adoption. So yes, we need to be patient. We don't, fulfill our mission overnight, but this is a driving force that when you start to deliver, like the curbside in New York are used like crazy. Like it's one of the best chargers we have on our network because people use it all the time, like around the clock, which is good. And back to your last question, Dominic, how do you locate chargers? One thing that I'm really proud is we've just launched last year an investment. We're going to deploy our own chargers. So usually our business model is we sell chargers to, for instance, a Con Edison. They buy them and we operate them and we're getting paid for them. And when people use them, we have a little piece of the transaction. Whereas as the industry mature, as we are a long-term company like us and we have reliable product, we want to be able to fulfill the gap on our network. Where maybe there's no customer that want to buy the chargers. So I want to be able to deploy our own infrastructure and take a risk on utilization. So when you take a utilization risk, what do you want? You want to hedge your risk. So with the database we've developed over time, knowing exactly how people use our station, exactly where, we know where we can put chargers for them to be more profitable. So what we do when we locate charger with our partners, for instance, in Canada, we're deploying 250 millions of ultra-fast charger in all provinces to be able to, stimulate the EV adoption, but also as business interested, a for-profit company, we know exactly the place where we're going to get 15, 20% of utilization and get a return on investment to convince our financial partners that we should invest more and more. So it's really about having a great networks that work, feeds you with data and with some machine learnings, with some geolocalization tools, you can layer additional traffic data with the usage and the consumer data to be able to really locate the best places to put chargers, not only for today, but for the next coming years with all the traffics, all the infrastructure that will be rolled out in the next 10 years that is already planned to making sure that you get a return and you satisfy your customer at the end of the day.
Wait, there was one thing that you brought up that I kind of wanted to go back on. You said it really quickly. When you said like the aesthetics, are you saying like some neighborhoods don't want the chargers in the neighborhood? Or like are you talking about how the chargers look in the neighborhood? I'm trying to figure out because the New York neighborhoods can be really, really picky on the aesthetics of the block.
No, they're not. The point is we all have opinions, right? And the thing is, what we love when we travel is every city is different, has a different flavor. And for instance, in New York, what we've done is we have our chargers, but we adapted the design of the pedestal to New York requirement. In some part, it's safety requirement. But the design, let's talk about it one second. You have the Link pedestal in New York, the gray, the square Link station where you have a screen. So for instance, this, the benches, the garbage bin, all of that as a signature, the lamppost as a signature. So when we bring chargers, of course, there's requirements. So you want something that fits together. So we adapted the pole where we have a retractable cable to look like New York. And if you look at our station, they really look New York. And they are amazing, by the way. Like, it's a really great product. But as you design a chargers, there's safety requirements, like hazards. This is why you have a big pole and you never have a cable that you can trip on the ground. And on the other side, if someone ran into a chargers in New York, we have tested with car crash, like they do in certification, that the pole will not injure the people in front, will get like that, will just bend over the car. With safety on the electricity, it will be a safety protection there. So there are so many details that when you want to do business with New York, you have to be patient for sure. But when you do it right, as we did, you have the great utilization, then the city now is ready to electrify big time and make an even bigger impact on the electrification of New York, five boroughs.
And just one more question on the actual chargers or installing them themselves, because you mentioned a lot a couple of minutes ago about how you guys have data. So you can tell like where people are using these chargers or sort of like what are areas where they'll get adopted and things like that. And so I'm curious, with all of that data, would you say that's like more data that this industry would have on the people who use it than say like the oil and gas industry? Like, because I was just starting to think about it in my head. Like, I drive a gas powered car and I'm like, do they really get any information from me when I go to these different gas stations about say like where they should add new state? Like, I don't know. Like, and there's also, of course, the safety and the security piece you have when you do have all this data on people in that way. And so I'm curious, you could just talk about it. Like, what is it like having all this data and like, how is that helpful for the industry? But also like, how do you guys have to like manage it?
I'm just hearing my general counsel telling me that we have privacy, we have cyber security, and we comply to everything, to SOC 2 and others, other bells and whistle. But yes, let's figure we comply to everything because it's really strict and we have to invest there. But you're right. You know, an EV is a computer on wheel first. So there's a lot more computing power in these cars. And in the charger, all chargers are connected because we want to be in constant making sure the charger works. There's new car coming to market that don't comply with the standards sometimes. So we need to do an over-the-air software update. Our mobile app, we have release every month to bring the experience forward because there's a new payment method. Because now we are roaming. For instance, Flow will roam with a charge point, which is a competitor based in California, but they allow their users to use the Flow network and Flow allow Flow network. So we're a competitor, but we want to bring the industry forward. And we do that with Shell Recharge and with other charging network. So there's so much software integration. And yes, that data, but the great thing about data, when you comply with all the rules, it just helps us to develop better product to install the charger where EV drivers want and really understand the journey of using a chargers to make the experience better.
Definitely. Switching gears a little bit to you and running this company and sort of how you've built it. What has it been like for you personally building this company? Because like you had this idea and you started originally wanting to build an electric vehicle and then have since moved into electric chargers, which you've been there for a while. But like, what has it been like actually building the company up for you personally?
Thanks for asking. It's been an amazing journey. I always wanted to be an entrepreneur. First, work for myself, do crazy things, change the world. That's really what I wanted to do. So I'm proud and every day I wake up and I'm energized because it's always new challenges. On the other side, what's as much important to me, it's not only what I call the direction, the why, like fighting climate change, bringing EVs in the road, offering the best charging experience, our why, but it's also the how. That's really important to me. And I'm really proud of Becca and Dominic. And when I say how, I'm not saying how do you do it. I'm saying how we behave. So the culture at Flow, something that I'm really proud of, and we start to have a big brand in North America, is we have a great culture. Culture of performance, but a great culture because we collaborate, we care. I call it sustainable performance. We want to deliver a lot, but you know, we want to live as well. What I mean by that is for 100 years, maybe we had an impact on our planet, the way we've developed our industry after the Second World War, the Cold War and everything. So we didn't care as much, and we had a big impact on our planet, but we didn't care as much about our people and the way we develop our, you know, our social, the way at work. So I'm really passionate about having a company that deliver revenues, that deliver profitability, that grows, that can be a worldwide player. But also, how can we make an environment where it's fun to work, we perform together, we care for each other, and we really, in good and bad times, are able to care about our people as much as in good times. So that's what we have at Flow. That is a big part of what I want to my company. And my biggest proud is after 15 years, 600 employees, the culture is there. I get hit by a bus tomorrow. I hope it will be an EV bus. This culture is going to continue and the mission is going to continue. So my biggest proud, but I really feel my expression is I'm on my X. I'm exactly where I want to be because every year it's a new challenge. Every year my CEO role is taken to the next level. And I want that. I want the growth and I'm ready for the growth.
You know, growing up, did you always want to be like an entrepreneur?
Yeah. Yeah. I was born an entrepreneur. At 8 years old, I told myself I would work for myself. At 11 years old, I start my business in snowboard clothing. I failed. I learned a lot. I learned something. If you want to start something, surround yourself with passionate people. But if you want to do something great, surround yourself with passionate people that are ready to pay the price to deliver, because it's really hard. Changing the world is really hard, and it's part of the culture at Flow. We're not only there to have fun. Yes, we want to have fun, but we're there to perform and pay the price to change the world. So definitely for my youth, I always wanted to be an entrepreneur, wanted to change things. I hated when people say, Louis, it's always been like that. It will always be. Oh, if you wanted to activate my passion, that was the sentence to mention. So yes, and it's why I was looking before I had the idea of Flow, before I had the idea of EVs. I really wanted to find something to change the world.
And so wise for an 11-year-old to kind of come to these conclusions. How did that snowboarding company go?
Oh, I think now ski is more. It's definitely, I would say, more important or bigger than snowboard. But when I was young, wasn't that big of a trend or something, but it's something that I started to do. So young, crazy, fool Louis wants his business and see an opportunity where something start trendy, you know, big brands, but I wanted to do something more affordable, something that people, you know, would be able to access more than the other big brand. And I started something. And again, an entrepreneur is a desire to do something. Whatever is the idea, it's an idea you want to do something. And I materialized that with snowboard clothing at the beginning because it was one of my first passion sports, snowboard. And I tried to turn that into a business, which wasn't the best journey, but a lot of learnings. And as an entrepreneur, it's really important to learn from your mistakes.
What advice would you give founders that are looking to really build a workplace culture that is passionate, that motivates people, that really is also, you know, healthy and all these things? But what advice would you give founders? Because I don't know, a lot of times we talk to founders about their work culture and their workplace, and I don't know how much thought they give it as they're building the company.
It's like they've never thought about it.
They're just like, work culture, what? So what advice would you have for founders in terms of balancing growing a company and making sure your employees actually want to stay working for you?
Yeah, I can give you a couple of thoughts. Yesterday, I was doing a conference, 2 hours discussion with 50, 60 entrepreneurs that are graduating from Laval University where I studied. And they always ask the question. It's the best question. And the only thing that I can do, but I can explode a bit on it, is go. If you really want to do it, go. But don't be too crazy about it. Like, try to understand the needs you're trying to solve. Sometimes the problem of an entrepreneur is they have so many ideas and you really need to focus at some point. And maybe, you know, you need to define your next milestone, but as much as you know the direction you're going, if you go with great people, you surround yourself, you'll learn, you'll try to avoid mistakes, you'll make a ton of mistakes. The worst that can happen, you'll have fun, you'll learn, and you'll be ready for the next journey. So I see too many people's, I want to be an entrepreneur. I think about something. Do it. Like as much as you can, You can calculate, you can plan, you know, starting something, it needs to spark at some point. So that's the advice I give to any young entrepreneurs that is wondering for years, you know, should I get a job? Should I start my own business? Surround yourself with great people. There's more people that want to help that you can tap into. Just start it. Jump.
Well, that seems like a perfect place to wrap. Thank you so much, Louis, for coming on the show. This has been fun.
Thanks. Was amazing.
That was our conversation with Louis. And before we jump into the outro, of course, we want to tell you what the lie was. And dear listeners, the lie was that working with both the US and Canadian governments was easier than expected. While he said it was easy and then explained after, dear listeners, you were not on the call with us. You could not see that he gave us a pretty big wink when he said it was easy, which is not surprising. But I definitely thought the concept of having to kind of navigate all these regulatory hurdles and policies, which seem to be changing all the time, is such an interesting space to be in as a company that got started before any of us were really paying attention to this category at all. What did you think about that, Dom?
I know. I wanted him to go deeper in terms of how severe things have shifted. Because I imagine in 2009, like, who was doing this? Or were people doing this? Like, I feel like this has become like a really, really big thing. Like, EVs having, like, she is the moment. I couldn't even imagine what it was back in the day. And then in the 90s, because he was talking about that's when he was like originally interested in it. I'm like, in the 90s, what was this space?
I know. And this is one of those things where I'm always like, oh, that surprises me that there's even kind of enough information to go off of when he originally launched. But then I'm like, maybe this is one of those areas where I'm like, we're so similar to Canada. And then this is one of those areas where like, we're not. Like, maybe people cared about it. And I mean, he said it wasn't super popular there either, but maybe it was like at least a little more popular. I mean, they're always ahead of us with stuff like this. So like, that wouldn't actually be that surprising.
That's actually true. I actually forgot about the Canadian part because it could have been a whole thing in Canada and we could have just been behind as we usually always are. So yeah, this could have been a major topic of discussion back in the day in Canada. But I mean, EVs are everywhere now. I was just looking outside or I Googled what the stations look like because I don't have a car. I don't know anything about car life. So when I was just Googling what the EV stations even look like, they just look like mini bus stops. I would not even have known that was a charging station.
I know. Like once he started talking about working with New York and how New York had like all of these specific guidelines it had to be to fit like the quote unquote New York look, I was like, oh my God, like I got to go down, won't say where I live, but like there's some down the street from me and I'm like, I got to go check it out. And like, I've never noticed, I didn't pay that much attention to them because I drive a car, but I don't have an EV, which is funny of this whole conversation in general, because the reason I didn't buy an EV is because I didn't think I'd be able to charge it in the city. And now, of course, literally like a month after I bought the car, New York was like, we're adding all these chargers. And I was like, well, all right. Like, I guess this will be my only non-EV. But yeah, now I'm like, I got to spot them because the ones on my street are really hard to notice. They're an EV, other than the fact that the poles are plugged into people's cars. Because they really don't stand out otherwise. So now I'm curious, how many are there?
And I was just thinking, I imagine people uptown saying, do not put an ugly charging station next to my kid's prep school. I will literally write the government. So that's why I was really wondering, I'm like, what do they even look like? Because I could not imagine, just for lack of a better word, like the neighborhoods allowing an ugly EV station, especially not uptown. But I don't know, could be stereotyping uptown. I wonder how I know that, not revealing how I might know that. But I thought it was interesting about the industry deciding that EVs should just have like two standardized chargers in a sense. And I find it interesting that the industry itself just collectively agreed on that because I don't know, like anytime there isn't like the government or like regulators forcing people to do anything, I'm like, okay, so you all just like met up one day and said, let's just make life easier. I'm like, that's so nice of you.
I know. And it is interesting to think about too, because obviously companies in the same category compete with each other. It's rare that you see these kind of coming together situations where they realized on their own that they probably wouldn't survive if they didn't band together in this way. Like, I don't know, like maybe they would, but it's a much easier sell to someone if they are concerned, like me, for example, like concerned with being able to actually find places to charge where you live, that if you're like, well, it doesn't matter what car you buy, you can charge it
on any of these. I could see it being like the tide that lifts all boats. But I mean, there are a lot of scenarios in business that would apply to, and you don't see people collaborating. So I definitely do think that is a really interesting factor here. And I mean, if you're a company like Flow, who is like working with both of the current chargers, and now it's like, oh, we're all moving to one, like, great, we can do that. It's just so interesting to think about. It's like Apple, of course, has to do the standard charger or move in that direction because the EU is making it. But yeah, like you said, it's so interesting that they kind of just like decided to do this on their own.
The EU bullied them. The EU is standing on business. They said, Apple, like, seriously, come on. I don't know why I'm like randomly angry about that. But this is something I wanted to ask, which this might be like a ridiculous question. If there aren't a lot of charging stations and you drive an EV and you get stranded in the middle of nowhere, what happens to you? Well, I guess like it's the same as like when you're not near a gas station, but what if like the only gas station doesn't have an EV charging station? Are you just like there?
I have like always wondered this. And like my dad has a Tesla and like he really likes it. And like they live somewhere where there are a lot of chargers and they have one at home also. But even when they drive to New York, they live in the Boston area, they absolutely never take that car pretty much, which is always so interesting. And like, maybe they've taken it like once where in theory, the range would be fine, but they're still just like, they don't want to push it because it's like, what do you do? Like, what do you do if you run out of charge?
Do you call like AAA? Like, what do you say? Where do they take you?
I guess I have no idea what would actually happen, or if it is, maybe it is just as easy as like if you run out of gas, where it's like they either tow you to a station or like you can put gas in your tank. Maybe AAA will come and give you a charge. I have no idea.
Wait, you're in Boston and they say the nearest EV is in New York. Do they tow you or do they just say, hey, you got to give it up? What do they say?
I know, because in some places you definitely would be a lot closer to a gas station, but could be really far from a charger.
Ugh. I don't know. See, these are the things I think about. I'm creating up scenarios.
These are the things like I think about. And then it's like, no, Becca, based on where you live, you would literally never have that problem. But I'm like, but unless like
this is literally made up. But you know what? Like really quickly, the cybersecurity element, which we didn't talk much about, was a really interesting point in terms of the data they're collecting. Because I was trying to think quick enough of what a hacker would want from EV data. I couldn't think of anything immediately, but I know that there are.
Yeah.
I mean, what would they do with that data?
Yeah, that's the thing. Because it's like, normally when you get in these conversations about cybersecurity, it's like so obvious, like why you wouldn't want the data to get out. But in this case, like it's definitely less obvious. And I like as someone who doesn't own an EV, like maybe it's like there's a lot of stuff in there that I'm just like not familiar with that would be really bad. But yeah, because it had never occurred to me until he said that, just how, because they are literally computers on wheels, which I've heard that saying before, but it never connected to me that it would be a lot easier to mine data from those cars than it would be from regular cars, which I know like you can mine regular data from cars. I spent a lot of time going down a rabbit hole to see if my car computer was sending my driving information to LexisNexis a few weeks ago after a New York Times story. But like, the gas and stuff, like, I don't think they could do anything with that. So it's weird. We're all too much data, big data everywhere. It's in your gas
tank
or your quote unquote, your electric gas tank or whatever. I don't know if they call it anything. Battery. That's the real word.
Yeah. Not that I'm saying that someone should hack an EV and, you know, surprise us with what they take.
And report back. Yeah.
Our cybersecurity team will have a story soon, I'm sure.
Yeah. All we're saying is we're not encouraging anyone to do that. But if you do, write it up and send it to us. We would love to read it because I'm now curious.
Yeah, if you don't mind prison time and a TechCrunch feature, we just want to know what happened.
Found is hosted by myself, TechCrunch senior reporter Becca Skutak, alongside senior reporter Dominic Midori-Davis. Found is produced by Maggie Stamets with editing by Kel. Our illustrator is Bryce Durbin. Found's audience development and social media is managed by Morgan Little, Alyssa Stringer, and Natalie Kreisman. TechCrunch's audio products are managed by Henry Pickovit. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week.